Welcome to Unpacking Zionism and our mini-series from Above on Zionist Political Institutions. I'm Yulia Gilic, and today I'm talking to Yusuf Munayer, head of the Palestine-Israel program at Arab Center, Washington, D.C. Rather than focusing on one specific Zionist organization, like other episodes in this series have been, today we'll discuss a host of Zionist institutions and a specific tactic that unites them. This episode is about lawfare. Lawfare refers to the use of law as a political weapon, particularly concerned with inflicting damage on an opponent. In this episode, we discuss Zionist lawfare, who formulates its goals and targets, and who funds and carries out these efforts. In the episode notes, we will link to three publications that form the basis of the interview and that we recommend for a deeper dive into the topic of lawfare. Yusuf wrote a chapter titled Spaces Beyond Borders in a book on suppressing dissent published in 2024. Emea Gilman's article in Jadalia, AstroTurf Antisemitism Watchdogs, also from 2024, and Charity and Security Network report from 2021 titled The Alarming Rise of Lawfare to Suppress Civil Society. Okay, let's get to it. Yusuf, thanks so much for joining me.
Very happy to be here.
Let's start with introductions. Tell us how you came to study and engage with Zionist institutions.
My name is Yusuf Munayer. I'm a Palestinian born in Lid, which is today inside Israel. So my engagement, I suppose, with Zionist institutions starts with my birth certificate. And because of all of these circumstances, of course, been very interested in the question of Palestine, the rights of Palestinians, have worked to study this and also educate others. And part of understanding how so much of this works, especially here in the United States, where there is a very strong tie to Zionism, a very strong tie to the Israeli government, is to understand how Zionist institutions, pro-Israel institutions function, what they work towards, how they implement strategy, and so on. So this becomes sort of an unavoidable topic to really understand U.S.-Israel relations and, of course, as a subset of that, America's relationship with Palestinians. More specifically, though, in recent years, I would say in the past decade and a half at least, we have seen a really significant growth in the efforts to silence, intimidate, coerce, or otherwise repress those speaking up on behalf of Palestinians or as Palestinians themselves in the United States, in Europe, elsewhere around the world. And part of my academic background is also in the study of political repression and human rights. And I became very interested in trying to understand what exactly is happening here. Now, for those of us who've been paying close attention, it's very clear that this is not happenstance, right? It's not a coincidence that all of this is happening at the same time, that a very common set of tactics seems to be repeated across borders, that, you know, similar actors seem to be involved, that common funders exist, and so on. So I wanted to try to understand, okay, what is happening here? And how is it happening? What strategy, if any, is at play? What are the connections between these different actors and so on?
We'll definitely discuss the tactics, primary actors, and donors in more detail, but let's back up a bit first. What is lawfare?
Very simply, lawfare is the effort to use the law or legal tools as a political weapon. And, you know, we certainly do not only see this in the Israeli-Palestinian context. It's actually far more common than that. There's all sorts of organizations, again, not necessarily Zionists, but on a whole range of different issues that seek to advance a political agenda. And there is an effort to use the law to advance those political agendas. Now, that is not necessarily lawfare. Using the law to advance a political agenda is not something that I would call lawfare on its own. Lawfare is when legal tools are used as a political weapon against opponents. But we've seen tons of legal activism, right? Legal activism that's used to support all kinds of political agendas. Everything from civil rights to parental rights to you name it, right? The legal arena is an arena where political agendas are clashing, and this is common. right? Lawfare, though, is a little bit different because it is the use of that legal space and tactics, not just to advance an agenda, but to go after opponents, a sort of offensive effort, right? And that I do think makes it something unique and distinct. This is not limited to Zionist organizations.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to clarify that lawfare is a more widespread tactic. It's not limited to Zionist institutions. So let's look at Zionist lawfare within this broader landscape. What makes it distinct?
One of the dynamics that we see that I do think is a little bit more rare is that the lawfare effort that is undertaken by Zionist organizations, and this is, I believe, a matter of coordinated strategy, is often coupled with a legislative effort. And this is something that we don't always see in other cases of lawfare. It's one thing to say, okay, let's use the law, the existing laws, to target our political opponents. How can we exploit the law as it exists to target our political opponents? It is another thing to say, in tandem with that, let's also advance new laws to create new avenues for attack against our political opponents. And while I don't think that's exclusive to Zionist organizations, it is something that is very prevalent as part of this Zionist strategy, where on the one hand, they are using existing laws to target political opponents, to attempt to target political opponents. But as part of the strategy, they are also working to advance new laws or redefine existing laws or statutes within existing laws to create a whole new set of platforms to launch lawfare attacks from. That is, I think, something that is a little bit more unique in this case.
Can you give us an example that illustrates this combination, right? The use of existing laws to attack political opponents coupled with efforts to advance new laws.
You know, in the United States in particular, right, we have certain laws on the books that protect our freedoms and our rights, specifically the U.S. Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the First Amendment around freedom of speech and assembly and so on. And this has been something that's been reaffirmed by the courts over time, which, of course, interpret these laws. And the right to boycott in particular is something that the court has been pretty clear is protected under the First Amendment. Now, we saw as part of the effort to attack, coerce, intimidate the movement for Palestinian rights that has practiced boycott, divestment, and sanctions, efforts to create new laws on the books in the United States, both at the state and federal level, that sought to punish those practicing boycotts against Israel. And there's a wide range of these. Some of them are at the state level. Some of them, as I said, are at the federal level. Some of them are at the municipal level. They differ in the ways that they operate. Some of them allow the states to engage in viewpoint discrimination. Some of them attach criminal penalties or other punitive measures, for example, against people who engage in boycotts of Israel. And so these legislative initiatives, I should say that there's probably not a whole lot of people, let's say, in Kansas or wherever that are spending hours on the phone with their representatives saying, hey, you know what we really need as constituents of your office here in Kansas? What we really need is a law that restricts people's boycott activity, right? That's not how this is happening. How this is happening is there's an organized effort, right? A perfectly legal, by the way, organized effort to advance legislative agendas at the state level and at the federal level to put these laws on the books, okay? So anti-boycott legislation is just one form of this. Other forms of this include redefining the meaning of anti-Semitism so that existing anti-discrimination law can then be used for the purpose of silencing criticism of Israel, right? So, and this is one of the things that becomes very clear as you study sort of these actors, right? These Zionist organizations and their agenda. They actually look at existing American law with a great deal of disdain. Because the way that they see it is that, well, under American law, as it currently exists, it's perfectly legal to criticize Zionism, to oppose Zionism. And for them, that's a problem. As Zionist organizations who not only are Zionists themselves, but want to sort of hegemonize the idea of Zionism in the Western public sphere, they don't want it to be okay for people to oppose Zionism and criticize it and so on. But there's this problem, is that we have this thing called free expression. We have this thing called the First Amendment. And it limits the extent to which the state can silence people for their criticism of anything. But there are certain exceptions to that, right? Like, there are a lot of things that you can say and get away with and criticize, but there are certain things that you're not allowed to do. And the courts have been clear on this, right? You cannot scream fire in a crowded theater, right? Because it has real security implications for the lives of people, okay? And so there are parameters to freedom of speech. And one of the limitations around speech is in the area of discriminatory speech, right? And so one of the things that these Zionist actors have sought to do is say, well, okay, if the First Amendment says that criticism of Zionism and opposition to Zionism is protected by the First Amendment, let's take Zionism and make it a protected class. Let's take Zionism and make criticism of Zionism discrimination. But to do something like that, to take a political ideology, whether it's Zionism or communism or capitalism or what have you, right? And say, well, actually, this set of ideas is now equivalent to a nationality or an ethnicity or a religion, and therefore beyond criticism. This is not something that you can legally criticize, or lest it be discrimination, right? To do that, you need a translator. You need a device that translates anti-Zionism into anti-Semitism. And part of the ways that this has happened is through the proliferation of a redefinition of anti-Semitism. And that redefinition of anti-Semitism, which sort of these Zionist actors have gravitated around, has been something called the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism. We can spend a whole lot of time talking about that.
And we have.
Yeah. But the important thing about this is not just about the language within this definition and so on. It's about the way it functions and the very deliberate way it functions to turn perfectly legitimate speech into speech that can now be quashed by the state. And one of the things that I argue, having looked at the strategy of these Zionist organizations over time, is that the shift towards the obsessive focus on proliferating the IHRA definition was in part a response to the limitation of anti-BDS laws. Because anti-BDS laws hit a wall called the First Amendment. And they needed to find a way to circumvent the First Amendment to continue doing what they ultimately aim to do, which is silence dissent around Israel, right? And the way that you do that is by saying, well, this speech is not normal speech. This speech is not protected speech. It's actually discrimination. And the way you know is this IHRA definition. And so part of the legislative efforts have been getting institutions, getting legislatures to adopt this definition into law, into practice, and then use it as a filter through which to interpret speech as either protected or not protected. And then, of course, to demand enforcement.
Yeah, this is a good illustration of how Zionist lawfare is a multi-pronged effort. So let's map out some of the major actors responsible for advancing these multiple prongs.
I would separate actors into a couple distinct categories. One category, which we can call government actors. And these are either officials or agencies of the Israeli government, as well as officials or agencies of governments where this repressive activity is taking place. So to pass anti-BDS laws, you need American government officials to actually do that, right? So this is one category of actors, government officials or agencies. Another category of actors are sort of non-governmental organizations, which are working often in a coordinated fashion with these government actors to advance this agenda. And a third group, I would call a donor class of funders, which is sympathetic, of course, and supportive to these aims, and is helping to finance the organizations that are working in tandem often with these government actors to advance this agenda. So we're talking about a few different categories here of actors. I divide them up this way because I think that each of these actors kind of has their own role to play. And in trying to understand this rise of repression in the last 20 years or so, what became clear to me is part of that rise, part of that significant escalation in repressive efforts was in part a product of the coordinated effort of government actors and non-government actors towards this end. And as I began to dig into the strategy behind this and where this came from, what became clear is that the Israeli government, as a matter of government policy, increasingly began to dedicate government resources, personnel, agencies, and other tools that are only available to first world states to this effort. And they did so by understanding that they could not do it alone as a government, that they needed partners, like-minded civil society organizations, because the change that they were trying to create was not inside Israeli-controlled territory. It was inside the United States. It was inside Europe. And so they needed allies in those spaces to coordinate with to achieve their objectives. And so they began implementing a strategy, which they talk about as using a network to defeat a network. This is the language that they use. You know, shifting, in their words, from defense to offense. This was some of the principles that sort of underlined the policy that they advance. And the reason behind this, the thinking behind this idea of shifting from defense to offense, there's been a debate in Israeli policy circles for many years prior to this about what the best way is to respond to growing international criticism of Israel, particularly in the global civil society space. If you are a supporter of Zionism and you back Zionist policies and you look out around the world, you see that there's a lot of people who don't like that. And the number of people who don't like that is growing. And you consider that to be a problem, a challenge, even a threat, right? And so how do you address this? Well, one of the theories for trying to address this, and there was a camp within sort of Israeli policy circles that supported this particular strategy, was, well, we need stronger public diplomacy. We need to better explain our story. We need to bring more people to Israel to see how wonderful things are here and, you know, take them on the Jewish Disneyland experience in the wonderful state of Israel so that they can see how we are making the desert bloom and all of the sort of propaganda. And this was primarily sort of led by diplomats in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in Israel.
This is Israel's Hasbara program, right? We had a webinar about it last year that we will link to in the episode notes if folks want to know more. But what is the reason Israel shifted from or had to supplement this, as they say, defensive Hasbara public diplomacy strategy with the more offensive moves like lawfare?
What became clear over time is that this failed. This failed because, you know, as much propaganda tours as you take people on, as much advertising as you spend on, as much goofy social media videos that you create, right? The reality on the ground that people are increasingly seeing is not one you can distract people from, particularly the horrific things that repeatedly took place in Gaza with repeated wars long before the most recent genocide began. And so they decided that this strategy was not working. And that they needed to shift from a strategy of defending Israeli policy to one of going on the offense against the critics, hence the shift from defense to offense. And this was a shift that was embodied in Israeli policy that changed in 2015 with the creation of something at the time called the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. It was a ministry that sort of existed previously, but a policy decision by the Security Cabinet was taken in October of 2015 to charge this particular agency with leading a government-led effort to combat boycott activism around the world. Okay? And the way that they went about this is in partnership with civil society organizations, and which they routinely met with, coordinated with, in the words of one of their officials, networks that they coordinated and empowered, right, to ensure that they had maximum impact. And one of the ways that they went about this was through the legal sphere, was through lawfare. But that was not the only way. There were other tactics that were used as well. We're focusing specifically on lawfare, but there were certainly others, the legislative initiatives being one of them, right? I mean, we have the Israeli prime minister talking about how, you know, Israel worked to promote laws in the United States and many different states that were anti-boycott laws. This is not exaggeration. They're taking credit for efforts that they work towards, right? And they're not really shy about it either. And there's a long range of Israeli government officials taking credit for these kinds of actions, among others, including lawfare actions, by the way.
Let's talk specifics. How did the Israeli government go about making lawfare into a tactic that Zionist organizations in the United States or in other countries then implement? How do they instigate lawfare from above?
They went about this by creating a specific network aimed at lawfare, something that they called the Legal Network Initiative. And this brought together lawfare actors from around the world that were focused on doing lawfare for Israel so that they can commonly strategize, so that they could share information and best practices, and so that they could advance the agenda of using legal tools to attack those who dare boycott, divest, or sanction, or call for that when it comes to Israel. And so there's a long list of actors that we can talk about. Some of them are more central, some of them are more peripheral, but it's very important to understand that this strategy, at the center of it, was an Israeli government effort, okay? And among these actors, there's, you know, a group of them, folks like the Brandeis Center for Human Rights, folks like the Lawfare Project, groups like Stand With Us, okay, groups like the UK Lawyers for Israel. There was an outfit called the International Legal Forum, which was an outfit that was essentially financed by the Israeli government, whose role it was to help coordinate this legal network internationally. I should say there's also a lot of lawyers who are not necessarily part of these organizations who are happy to give their time and effort to support this strategy. And so groups like the International Legal Forum, right, played a role in organizing these lawyers, these legal volunteers around the world for the purpose of bringing them onto lawsuits, right, and having them support the efforts that many of these civil society organizations were already willing to and focused on pushing forward. And then finally, you have a donor class, right, that is supporting these efforts. A lot of familiar names here behind a number of these organizations, the Adam Milsteins of the world, the Sheldon / Miriam Adelsons of the world, and then many other foundations, communal foundations within the sort of Jewish philanthropic space that are largely focused on supporting right-wing Jewish causes, but not exclusively. And one of the interesting things looking into this is that there is a lot of money that goes through some of these Jewish federations that go to a wide range of purposes. And some of them are to support these lawfare actors as well. So that's just sort of a brief breakdown on who some of these groups are and what type of groups and individuals and we're talking about.
Okay, so we know who some of the major actors are. How can we track what they're up to?
So there's a tremendous amount of information that just is open source and available online, often posted by the actors themselves, talking about what their agenda is, what they intend to do, who they plan to target, et cetera, et cetera. So it doesn't require a tremendous amount of imagination to think about where they plan to go. One thing I would draw attention to is that, you know, historically, the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs had tried as a matter of its strategy to focus on specific organizations. They refused to believe that opposition to Israeli policy can be an organic thing. It has to be part of a network-driven action that is driven from the top down and can be boiled down to a small group of actors, right? And they identify these actors and then try to target them. And so, you know, in 2016 or so, the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs released a list of organizations that it banned from Israel and that it said was involved in backing the boycott movement. And they attempted to connect these folks to terrorism and anti-Semitism and so on. So they're pretty transparent in what their focus is. And it shouldn't be surprising that in the years following that, a number of lawfare actors use lawfare tactics against those very organizations, right? So, you know, one doesn't have to go very far to connect the dots here. I did notice that the other day, the successor to the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which is today an agency in the Israeli government called the Ministry for Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism. And if one sort of follows the Israeli bureaucracy, what happened here over time is that the staff that was working at the Ministry of Strategic Affairs on these issues moved briefly to the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and then was reconstituted in this new agency, the Ministry for Diaspora Affairs, which was renamed the Ministry of Diaspora Affairs and Combating Anti-Semitism. And so this is where this work is being done now. And they have now put out a new list of organizations that, you know, they have banned from Israel because these groups are demanding accountability for war crimes, you know, committed by either high-ranking Israeli officials or Israeli soldiers. So I would not be surprised if these are what the next steps are going to be, right? If past this prologue, this is what we should expect.
I want to ask you about this. Zionist organizations often claim that it is the Israeli state and its representatives that are the true victims of lawfare, right? That civil lawsuits and criminal investigations for war crimes are supposedly designed to harass and intimidate Israeli officials. This is, of course, not to say that we should take these claims at face value. But I do want to take them seriously as an example of Zionist smear designed to muddy the water and deny legitimacy to legal attempts to redress Israel's atrocities. What's your take on this?
I guess anyone who uses the law for anything, you could call it lawfare, right? If you want to. But I think a person who is looking to redress a grievance, right, through the law, is using the law legitimately. If an Israeli general has given orders to commit war crimes, there is legal recourse for that, and there should be. And using that is not lawfare. You know, that's why the law exists, right? To protect people's rights, to hold power to account. It's when the law is weaponized in a way to attack political opponents that I believe it becomes lawfare. And it's always dressed up in the language of protection, in the language of rights and so on. But when one scratches the surface, you realize that that's not really what it's about. And actually, they're quite transparent that it's not what it's about. It's about combating this movement as a movement and using the law as a tool to do that.
It really brings to mind that phrase that every Zionist accusation is a confession, right? So it's a bit ironic to see Zionist portrayals of the Palestine Solidarity Movement as a network, top-down, from-above kind of effort.
There's no doubt that there are network components. I mean, at the end of the day, we're talking about social movements, right? In any social movement, there are going to be key actors, less important actors. There are going to be folks working on strategy, working on coordination, and so on. But when we're looking at something of the scale and the scope of global outrage at Israel over its actions, this is not something that's being driven by a small handful of organizations. This is something that's being driven by the conscience of the world that is absolutely revolted by what they're seeing on the ground. I think it's giving a heck of a lot of undue credit to a small number of actors to think that they're actually responsible for this tidal wave of opinion that's shifted in recent years, especially against Israeli policy. It's really not that, but they want to believe it's that. They need to believe it's that. And the reason that they do is, if it's not that, then you have to start wondering, well, maybe something's wrong with the policy. Maybe we shouldn't be carrying out war crimes. Maybe it's not that the entire world is evil and anti-Semitic and hates Jews and is part of this global conspiracy, but they just don't want to see people treated like garbage, right? But then that requires pointing the finger in the other direction, and that's a lot harder to do.
Can we talk about who stages opposition to Zionist lawfare? What does that space look like?
I mean, I think the first thing I want to say is that the battle around lawfare itself is itself part of the problem, right? And what I mean by that is, okay, you have all of these, you know, crazy lawsuits, you have all of these, you know, claims of discrimination and so on, many of which have zero basis. And there is an ecosystem of organizations and actors which are responding to this, right? But part of the problem is that this is even going on, right? Because, and I will quote here a lawfare actor that's part of this sort of broader Zionist legal network from Spain, who I watched in a webinar. This was several years ago. He said, look, even if we lose the debate about whether or not anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism, at least we're not talking about apartheid. And so when the fight is no longer about the fight, but about the fight to have the fight, right? It itself serves a purpose of distraction and repression. And that, I think, is an under-discussed part of this, because a lot of these lawsuits, we see the way that the courts have responded to some of this stuff. They've treated it with ridicule because so many of these claims are just absurd, you know? And many of these judges get frustrated over time because, why are you wasting my time with this nonsense? But they're perfectly happy to waste time and effort and resources on nonsense so that it's not being spent talking about what is happening on the ground. It's not being spent talking about apartheid or genocide or what have you, right? And even if they lose that fight, that's still the fight that they prefer to have. So that part of it, I think, is really important. And of course, there is a wide range of organizations and actors who are involved in kind of pushing back against this. And at the forefront of them are groups that care about constitutional rights and the First Amendment and genuinely free speech, right? Because at the end of the day, this is what it comes down to. If I can't organize and speak out about something that I believe in, whether it's Palestine or animal rights or the climate or whatever, right? Then a fundamental bedrock principle of democracy that we all rely on, that we all need, right, is being destroyed. And so you have groups that are Palestine specific, but also groups that have nothing to do with Palestine whatsoever engaged in this pushback effort because they understand what this is, right? They understand that this is a bad faith effort that has implications that are much broader than Palestine and are destroying some of our most important norms in our society.
I think this is a really important connection to draw, because these are the groups and movements that have been and continue to be repressed through the use of anti-terrorism laws.
Yeah, as I conducted research into these organizations and the sort of the government strategy, one of the things that I came across that was fascinating was a slide from a presentation that was given by an official, the operations director of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, laying out the main activities of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. And number one on the list of five or six different main activities was reputational damage. And under that, it said BDS equals terrorism, BDS equals anti-Semitism. And so the effort to tie perfectly legitimate protected activity to things that are illegitimate and often illegal, right, was a deliberate and calculated part of government policy. Because, and I'll quote here another Israeli general who famously said, you know, we in the Israeli military, we don't do Gandhi well. We don't do Gandhi well. What does that mean? It means that the Israeli state is perfectly comfortable dealing with somebody running up to a checkpoint with a rifle, right? They are perfectly comfortable dealing with an intelligence threat, right? What they're not really equipped to deal with is advocacy. What they're not really equipped to deal with is people who are using their words, people who are organizing other people completely within the bounds of the law to call for change. It doesn't help to use the tools that they're used to using against that. So they need to find a different way to address it. And the way that they are most comfortable addressing it is by converting it into the things that they are comfortable dealing with. Because then they have the tools at their disposal. Then they know how to respond to these things. And so they need to frame it as something different than it is. They need to turn protected activity into illegal activity. And they literally put it on a slide with an equal sign, right? Because this was the very focus of the effort. And they understood it was a key part of what they needed to do.
I want to end with a kind of meta question and ask you about how journalists and scholars can reproduce this kind of research. I really appreciate the clarity and detail that you bring to this conversation and hope to see more of this kind of research that tracks the strategy, how it's disseminated and implemented. This seems really crucial.
The first thing I would say is that I've published a fairly lengthy chapter last fall in a book that just came out called Suppressing Dissent, Transnational Repression, and Israel-Palestine that details the research that I've done specifically into the role of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. So people who are interested in sort of more details and also the receipts, that's where I would start.
Yes, and we'll link to the chapter and the whole book in the episode notes.
The other thing I would say is that, look, there's a tremendous amount of open source material about this. There's so much willfully posted online by many of these actors who outline clearly what their strategy is. And so what I have found most useful is just quoting these people in their own words. They are telling us what they intend to do, and then they do it. That's when it comes to a lot of these sort of civil society actors. The other thing about a lot of these civil society actors is that, it's particularly those based in the United States, but not exclusively, is that, you know, they're required to maintain a degree of transparency when it comes to their finances. And so a lot of that information is also publicly available. Some of it is not as easy to find as others, but a lot of it, if you spend the time digging, it's not hard to understand what is the network of actors and donors that are primarily focused on this work, right? The other part of it is that there is a lot of information that is publicly released by the Israeli government about the efforts of the Israeli government. Now, some of that material is easier to access than others, but there's a tremendous amount out there. There has also been a lot of work done by journalists, including journalists inside Israel and, you know, civil rights and liberties organizations inside Israel, who have used freedom of information law within Israel to have information about the inner workings of these agencies released. So, you know, there's no shortage of information. There's no shortage of receipts. And a lot of these actors, including government officials, say quite openly, hey, this is what we're doing. You know, we work to get 30 laws passed in U.S. states, and there's 50 lawsuits in Europe, and activists are being arrested and bank accounts are being shut down. I mean, you don't have to pry this out of them, right? They post it themselves online because they're proud of it and they don't feel that they're going to be held accountable for these things, right? So for researchers, it's actually a very rewarding path of research to go down because there's no shortage of material. You'll have to do some work. You'll have to dig down some rabbit holes, but there's a lot out there.
This was so helpful. Thanks so much, Yusuf.
You are very welcome.
Listeners, check out the resources we shared in the episode notes and subscribe to our podcast. We will have some important news and announcements in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned. Until then, solidarity from the Institute for the Critical Study of Zionism.